Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning. If you are wanting to call me, this is the perfect time to do it because I've got lines open. They're already starting to fill up, but there are a couple left. Call 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I want to start off with just a quickie email. Actually, this was a tweet that came my way yesterday from Cliff. And Cliff says, Patrick, in the St. Michael prayer, I see a lot of safeguard instead of defense and cast instead of thrust. I find this disturbing. I'm supposed to blame Vatican II, right? Is that how it works? All right, Cliff. I don't know whether you're just, you know, joshing around here. I can't tell if you're saying this tongue-in-cheek or if you really mean it. Really, I don't know exactly what you mean. Why on earth would this disturb you? So I guess my first reaction would be to say this is an odd question. I suppose there's no such thing as a dumb question. I certainly wouldn't say that's a dumb question. It's a reasonable question, but it's odd. I've never heard anybody object to some of the variations on the wording, like be our safeguard against the wickedness and snares of the devil instead of be our defense against the wickedness and snares of the devil. What's the qualitative difference there? I mean, it's like a distinction without a difference, if you ask me. Talking about Satan here, you know, cast him into hell instead of thrust him into hell. What's the qualitative difference? So I guess my reaction is, A, I don't understand why you would find this disturbing, which is why I wondered if maybe you were just, you know, funning around here, because I couldn't see how this could be something that would make anyone disturbed. And I guess if you're saying, should you blame Vatican II? Also, is that tongue-in-cheek? Well, no, don't blame Vatican II. First of all, the prayer was written long before Vatican II. And if it had more, I don't know, maybe if it had the words defense and thrust instead of safeguard and cast, okay, but so what? I guess that's my question. So what? What's the difference? It doesn't change anything. And for that matter, Pope Leo XIII wrote this prayer in Italian, I presume. It might have been Latin. I haven't gone back and checked, actually. He might very well have written it in Latin, because back in those days, you know, if you were a bishop or a cardinal, and certainly if you were a pope, you were a Latinist because everything was in Latin. Did you know, Cliff, that in the seminary studies, until about the time of Vatican II, even though it continued into that time, when you got into your four final years of seminary training, that would be the theology section of your training, most all of your theology was taught in Latin. And you read it in Latin, and the professor might even discourse in front of the chalkboard in Latin. So it was a translation from whatever the original language was. And I don't think you need to blame Vatican II. Just over time, there can be slightly different versions of the same prayer, but no biggie, honestly. That's the best way I can answer your question. I'm not sure what else to tell you. For those of you who follow polls, and I find them interesting, they don't necessarily mean anything beyond here's what people are thinking, but a Quinnipiac poll that was just taken out, it was actually kind of looking at President Biden's approval rating. It's now at 26% among Hispanics, and that's what this statistic here is looking at, and that is the Hispanic shift away from the Democratic Party seems to be in full swing. So Joe Biden is at 26% approval rating among Hispanics, and that's lower than his rating with whites, and that's already fairly low. If you're interested in seeing all the statistics here, because they break it down by Republican, Democrat, Independent, men and women. So if you'd like to see how those things break, it's just interesting to see that whereas it used to be, I think, considered settled science that Hispanics in the United States were foursquare in support of the Democratic Party, it seems to be changing. And, you know, it's a poll, so all it is a snapshot, but it's an interesting snapshot, if nothing else. Also, for your good-to-know file, and this made me feel good because I am bilingual, but this article points out some new scientific research that shows that if you are bilingual, in other words, if you speak, I don't know, Spanish and English or Chinese and English or some combination or maybe more than two, your likelihood of your brain aging faster goes down. So if you've squandered your New Year's resolution to learn a new language, here's a sign not to give up. This new research suggests that bilingual brain can delay aging brain. Knowing more than one language can help in lowering the number of dementia and neurodegenerative diseases. Doesn't neurodegenerative have a show, like a daytime talk show, Cyrus? Or am I thinking of somebody else?
Are you talking about The View?
Oh, no. Ellen DeGeneres. That's what
I see where you're going. All right.
Yeah. That was a dumb joke. Let's see. So it can slow it down. You might notice sagging skin or wrinkles as the first sign of aging. Your brain goes through anatomical changes in the gray and white matter of multiple brain regions. It's known as cognitive aging. The brain has trouble processing new information and creating short-term and episodic memory, as well as visuospatial function. That's a cool word. How's your visuospatial function today, Cyrus? Is it functioning?
I think it's still waking up, and I'm hoping this cup of coffee will help.
Splash some coffee on it.
Yeah, that'll help my vision.
Okay, here's a pop quiz. Okay, conjunction, junction, fill in the blank.
What's your function?
There you go. See? You have episodic memory.
Is that what that is?
Your visuospatial function may not be functioning, I don't know, but you do have episodic memory. Conjunction, junction.
What's your function?
Right, okay. You're doing okay, Cyrus. How many languages do you speak?
Barely one.
You're actually, you know, your English is pretty good, I must say. And your accent is pretty good.
Thanks. I've been working on it for a long time.
I mean, from an Oregonian, you're doing pretty well.
At least you say it correctly, which is nice to hear.
Oregonian?
Yeah, I hear a lot of Oregon.
Why do people say Oregon? Why do they say that?
Maybe the same reason they say Washington.
Yeah. They've been brainwashed.
That's right.
The bad news is that you can't stop the aging process. However, the speed at which your brain ages depends upon your cognitive reserve, the brain's ability to cope with age-related brain damage while maintaining optimal performance. The cognitive reserve doesn't happen overnight. It grows throughout a person's life. When neural networks are strong, cognitive reserve is influenced by a person's fitness level, diet, leisure activities, education level, socioeconomic status, among others. But this current study in which they studied the cognition of a bunch of adults. Thank you. They studied a bunch of adults 60 years and older with no psychiatric or neurodegenerative problems. That's a hard word to pronounce quickly. Each person could partially understand a second language, even if not fluent. Researchers distributed a questionnaire on their level of education, social relationship, and other items to gauge their cognitive reserve levels. They also filled out how long they knew a second language and how often they used it in everyday life. After the questionnaire, each participant was given a flanker task to measure their inhibitory executive control. And you know how I like to use that around the studio. Uh-oh, he's using his inhibitory executive control again.
Every day.
And no one even knows what that means. There was shown a row of five arrows with the target or central arrow being the key stimulus. The arrows on either side of the central arrow would point in the same or opposite direction, in some cases replaced by other objects. It gets, you know, somewhat boring as you try to explain it. But the long story short here is that the people who knew a second language or even somewhat knew a second language, they scored higher. And over time, the correlation seems to be that their brain will age less quickly. Hence, probably lower rates of dementia. Or if there is dementia, it will take place later in life, not earlier, which is a good thing. So there you have it, Cyrus. Time to break out the Duolingo on your phone and start learning Latin.
That news doesn't surprise me in the slightest. That makes sense. I mean, you use it or lose it, right?
Yeah, that's true. Are you familiar with that app, Duolingo?
Yeah, my wife loves it. She's constantly going back and forth between Spanish and French. I don't know how far she gets, but she's she's always using it.
I've done the Latin course, I've done the Spanish course, I've done the French course, and I've done the Italian course. So, and then after a while, I kind of got bored with it. But it is a very... Oh, the one thing about it, though, I do recommend it in terms of the ease of learning a language or brushing up on a language maybe you've already studied, but it is super ideologically transgender and gay. It's super LGBT.
Come on, man.
Oriented. Yeah. So they, you know, they go out of their way to do that. So just FYI, if you're cruising through Duolingo, you can expect to see that. 888-914-9149. How about Bill in Louisville? Good morning, Bill from Horse Country. Welcome.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
I have a Protestant wife who does not believe in purgatory.
Okay.
I'd like to know, is it in the Bible, mentioned in the Bible, and if so, where?
So well, yes and no.
About it.
Sure. Yes and no, maybe I should say no and yes. So it is not mentioned by name in the Bible in the same way that the word Trinity is not mentioned by name in the Bible. But it is described in the Bible in various places. So let me give you what I think to be the premier example of this. It's in 1 Corinthians chapter 3. And in it, St. Paul says, as he's describing a man who has built his house or his, the temple of his life on the foundation of Christ, he says, like a wise master builder, I laid a foundation and another is building upon it. For each one must be careful how he builds upon it. For no one can lay a foundation other than the one that is there, namely Jesus Christ. If anyone builds on this foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, or straw, the work of each will come to light, for the day will disclose it. I'll pause there. The day that's being referred to here is the day that you're judged. So when you die, the first thing that happens to you is you have your exit interview. Hebrews 9:27, it's appointed to a man to die once and then the judgment. So that's your exit interview. And that's what this is alluding to. So the day will reveal the work of that person's life. It will be revealed, it says, by fire or with fire. And the fire will test the quality of each one's work. If the work stands that someone built upon the foundation, that person will receive a wage. Some translations say reward. But if someone's work is burned up, that one will suffer loss. The person will be saved, but only as though through fire. So if we pause for a moment and kind of look at the constituent parts of this passage, we see purgatory, although the word purgatory is nowhere mentioned. It's referring to something that happens after the person dies. It is something that involves pain because the wood, the hay, and the straw, as analogous to the bad works and the effects of sin in life, those are purified away. Those are purged away, you might say. It seems that the gold, the silver, and the precious stones, the good works, that they remain, but the stuff that's incompatible with God gets burned away. We're told it takes some time for this to happen. And we also know that he's not in heaven yet. He says he will be saved. So he's not saved yet in the final sense. He will be saved, but only as though passing through fire. So right there, you see a very compact, very succinct explanation or description, rather, of what the Catholic Church calls purgatory. You can call it anything you want. Honestly, it doesn't have to be called purgatory. You could call it purificatory. You could call it, the fires of God's love. I mean, the name itself is, in a way, kind of irrelevant. And all purgatory simply means is that there is where God purifies the soul from anything that would prevent the soul from being perfectly united with God for all eternity. Revelation 21:27 says that nothing unclean can enter heaven. So in terms of, you know, passages that really kind of get to the heart of what this is all about, that seems to me to be the clearest one. There are others. So for example, where Jesus talks about the unforgiving servant, and I know you know this story, where he owes a great debt and he pleads for mercy. He pleads for, to have his debt remitted, and the master has mercy on him. And he says, all right, I'll cancel your debt and go your way. So now he's out from under the burden of his debt. He goes out in the street and he finds a fellow servant who owes him, by comparison, a very small amount of money, but he does not have mercy on him. he actually grabs him and says, pay me what you owe. And the man says, I can't. I don't have the money right now. So instead of showing mercy, what he does is he throws that man into debtor's prison. And so Jesus is telling this story, and he concludes it by not only saying that the man had his debt reinstated, which is also an evidence that one can lose his salvation. So the whole context of this has to do with what's going to happen at the end of your life. And so his penalty had been canceled out by the judge, but it gets reinstated because his fellow servants, they tattle on him. So then when Jesus is finished with this story, here's what he says. He says, in his anger, his master delivered him to the jailers until he should pay all his debt. Now, I think the King James Version, which I don't have in front of me, but I believe it says, until he has paid the uttermost farthing. And that's like saying down to the last penny. The very last penny must be paid. So the implication here is that at some point he will be allowed out of this debtor's prison once he has paid the price for this unjust action. And then Jesus concludes in verse 35 by saying, so also my heavenly Father will do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother from your heart. Now, clearly, Jesus did not mean that God is going to put you in a physical prison. He's not going to send you to the Supermax prison in Colorado. He's talking about what will happen afterward. And so this fits in with what St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, that there's a conclusion to this. It happens, and then when it's over, you move on to heaven. So there are two, and I can give you some resource suggestions, Bill, if you want, but how do those two sit with you? You think that'll be helpful to you in a conversation with your wife?
Yes, they will.
Okay.
I just wanted to know where to go, because she said, well, if it's in the Bible, and I said, well,
it is. It's right there in black and white.
Well, it is, yeah.
And she may object to the term purgatory not being in the Bible. That's okay. All you have to do there, a few things you can say. Number one is say, well, do you believe in the Trinity? Yes. Well, where is that word in the Bible? And the answer is nowhere. It was coined by one of the fathers of the church, and it was coined about a little bit less than 200 years after the time of Jesus. So it wasn't as though the doctrine of purgatory didn't exist. It did, but they just didn't have a word for it yet. And eventually that word was developed as a way to describe what the Bible was teaching, and something similar is happening here with purgatory.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. And I would suggest that you go over to Catholic.com and take a look at some of the tracts that they have. Electronically, they're free, and they have one on purgatory, as I recall. They have just about any Bible topic, they have a tract available, and maybe reading it on a screen might be easier than ordering a paper copy of it, but you can do that too. I hope that helps, and I appreciate the call, Bill. Thank you. Time out, and we will come back. And I want to share with you something I thought was very intriguing and very helpful, and that is how to recognize the different forms of pride in your life, and mine too, for that matter. We all have it. So you want to know how to figure out what kind of pride you're prone to? I'll share with you a resource that will help you do that. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Cyrus, a little bit of life advice, if you don't mind.
I'm listening.
Don't be condescending. That's when you talk down to somebody.
Thank you for mansplaining that to me.
Yeah.
That's, yeah.
Mansplaining. What a dumb term. Oh, that reminds me. I remember on Twitter, this is going back, I don't know, 2 years ago maybe. And you know the comedian Jim Gaffigan?
Yeah, he's funny.
Yeah, he is a funny guy. Well, yeah, I think he's very funny. I think he's insanely funny. But sometimes he crosses a line or two that makes me cringe. But in any case, his wife, Janine Gaffigan, whom I don't know. I mean, I know of her, but I don't know her. Whatever it was that I tweeted, I don't remember now what it was. I was probably answering somebody's question or something. And her retort to me was something like, thanks for mansplaining it for us.
Did you say, you're welcome?
No, I said, happy to help.
That's good.
Yeah, and then she pressed the like button. Awesome. So I give her credit for that. She sense of humor.
Yeah, she's got a great sense of humor. Mm-hmm. I mean, she has to, right?
Well, as I understand it, I think she's a big part of the writing team for all of his, comedy stuff. So if that's any, indication, then yeah, she's a very funny lady. But
are you being serious? Is that true?
Yeah, as far as I know, I believe that she is a big part of, I'm sure he writes probably a lot of his own stuff, but as I understand it, she also writes comedy bits for him as well. I just don't know which is which. Maybe they write them in tandem or something.
That's cool. A husband-wife team. Mm-hmm. Good for them.
Yeah, so as far as his humor is concerned, for as long as I've known him about him, as long as he's been putting out specials, Nancy and I will watch them. And generally, I think they're quite funny, actually. Every so often, especially, I think maybe one of the more recent ones when he just kind of slammed the Catholic Church in a gratuitous way. And maybe it was talking about different religions. I forget exactly what it was, so forgive my inexactitude here. And his one-liner about the Catholic Church was, we like pedophilia or something like that. It was just really, it was one of those groaner moments. You didn't really say that, did you?
Well, as a comedian, you're always firing, right? And every once in a while you're going to miss and you got to keep rolling and you got to take those chances. And it's like, well, I hope this joke works. Oh, that one didn't work. All right, moving on. Let's see what else works.
That one definitely didn't work.
Yeah, that's too bad.
I would put a red line to that one for future reference because, it just didn't fit with everything else, which was hysterically funny. And then that's almost like a punch in the gut. Ha, 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 punch in the gut. Ha, 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 ha. It doesn't really fit. That was my reaction to it.
Yeah, that's too bad. I didn't see that.
So do you feel like I've sufficiently mansplained all this?
Yes. All right.
You don't have to answer. Okay. I want to get to this article here, The Four Types of Pride and How to Root Them Out, which is very appropriate as we approach the last few days of Lent. And by the way, we are continuing with what we promised we would do, Father Rocky and the Close to Jesus to the Last moments during the day, 11 a.m. Central and 6 p.m. Central. Father Rocky delves into the events of Jesus's last days before his passion, and we are now in that time frame. We're moving into the Triduum, and Holy Thursday today is the night that Jesus celebrated the Last Supper, the very first Mass, and that's where he ordained the apostles to the priesthood. So join us for that, 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. Central. You'll also have two opportunities tomorrow to pray the Stations of the Cross, Good Friday. Noon will be with Bishop Robert McClory, and that'll be from the Shrine of Christ's Passion in St. John, Indiana. And then again at 3 p.m. tomorrow, Good Friday. And these times are Central Time, and that'll be with Father Rocky from the Chapel of the Nativity in Green Bay. We'll also be broadcasting on Holy Saturday, the Easter Vigil Mass, which here will be 12:30 p.m. Central Time, and that will have the Pope at the Vatican celebrating the Easter Vigil Mass. It'll be right here on Relevant Radio. You don't need to go anywhere else because it'll all be right here. And if you want a guide to all of this, just go to relevantradio.com or click on the Relevant Radio app, and you will find all of the things lined up. So here's the article. I found it helpful. I think you will too. The seven deadly sins are so insidious because they often take root to such a degree that they manifest as immutable personality traits. We say someone has a temper rather than admit he habitually commits sins of anger. We claim he's a cheapskate rather than recognize the sin of avarice. We know that pride is the chief of the seven deadly sins. As such, it is omnipresent at the root of other sins. By the way, pressing pause here for a minute, that's from straight out of St. Thomas Aquinas. St. Thomas said that inordinate love of self is the root of all other sins, which is another way of saying that your pride is your biggest problem. Mine too, by the way. The jury's still out on Cyrus. We're not sure yet. But almost all other human beings have a pride issue, and it is the root cause of all your other sins. Mine too. It is Satan's downfall in his non serviam. That is a Latin phrase which means I will not serve. And we sort of tag Satan with that, saying that whatever the test was that the angels went through, it involves something that for those who failed the test, it was their pride. And non serviam would have been what we imagine him saying to God, I'm not going to serve you. So back to the article, pride disrupts the supernatural order by placing an individual, fallible person's judgment and will above that of God's. Essentially, it constitutes an idolatry of yourself. As ubiquitous as pride is, it can be the most difficult sin to diagnose. Think about your typical examination of conscience as you go through the Ten Commandments. How often do you define pride as a clear, confessable violation of God's law? Or how often does pride instead lurk in the background of our consciousness, ossifying into a core of stubborn sin that further and further separates us from God? We typically think of pride as the caricature of the braggadocious snob. But there are many nuanced ways in which you commit sins of pride by making an idol out of yourself. In the most basic sense, every sin ultimately is a sin of pride because it represents a turning away from God's will to serve your own will. And he talks here about an examination of conscience by Father James McElhoney, and it's called Rooting Out Hidden Faults. And if you take a look at this article, there's a link to this. So you'll find this article that I'm sharing with you on the show page, which is relevantradio.com/Patrick. Just go there. You'll see it on the right side where the Twitter feed is embedded. And there are links in here. So in this examination of conscience, he identifies four discernible types of pride. His nuanced analysis shows that these lesser-known prides can often manifest as dispositions of the soul, thereby evading detection in routine examinations of conscience. He provides a useful guide to the characteristics of each form of pride and supplements his explanations with insightful questionnaires to prepare for confession. So let's go through this, shall we? The first of the four, pride of superiority and authority. Pride of superiority and authority. This is the typical narcissistic, angry, entitled type of pride. That kind of pride of authority is manifested by an overbearing, critical, argumentative attitude. Pride of authority is mean, unkind, disregarding justice and fair play. The pridefully superior will often seek to control others and gain outward markers of power and status. To determine whether pride of superiority has any hold in your soul, ask yourself these questions. Do I hold myself above others? Do I have a superior attitude? Am I prone to belittling others? Am I inclined to be bossy? Do I speak ill of others? Do I insist on having the last word? And do I have an irritable disposition? Pride of timidity is the second category. It's a type of self-love that ironically manifests as self-hatred. The timidly prideful live in fear of what others may think about them. While it may seem to be the opposite of pride, pride of timidity is actually an inverted form of pride because it is still motivated by a disordered self-love. The key error for those with this kind of pride is an overvaluing of human respect, that is, the opinion of others over the opinion of God. For those plagued by these feelings, a diagnosis of pride may come as a shock, but truly it is freeing because it can be rooted out through restoring a healthy sense of self in relationship to God. So how do you identify this type of pride? Here are some questions to ask yourself. Am I easily embarrassed? Am I self-conscious? Do I compare my talents with those of others? Do I exaggerate my weaknesses? Do I hide my talents? Am I so afraid of my mistakes as to not try at all? Do I stay with the crowd to be right or wrong, whether it's right or wrong? Good questions. Also, I'll add a few of my own. This is not in the article, but do I refrain from saying something or not saying something on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram or in some other public setting because I'm worried that I might lose followers or that somebody might give me a thumbs down or a critical comment? That could be another way. The third category is pride of sensitivity. This is another type of inverted pride and is similar to the pride of timidity and results from self-love being wounded. So the priest aforementioned says he makes himself feel bad. He wants to feel bad. He gets a false joy out of it. We're reminded of St. Jane Frances de Chantal's admonition. She, by the way, was a contemporary of Introduction to the Devout Life, St. Francis de Sales. She says, must you continue to be your own cross? Not that a wife would ever say that to a husband or a husband would ever say that to a wife. Must you continue to be your own cross? And mine too, for that matter. No matter which way God leads you, you change everything into bitterness by constantly brooding over everything. For the love of God, replace all this self-scrutiny with a pure and simple glance at God's goodness. How do you root out this kind of pride? Ask yourself these questions. Am I distrustful? Am I ready to accuse others of being unjust or unfair to me? Do I misjudge or misrepresent others or misinterpret them? Am I unable to laugh at myself? Am I moody? Do I brood about things? Do I carry grudges? I think these are all very well placed darts on the dartboard, right? And the last of the four is this one, pride of complacency, and vanity is another name for it. Like pride of timidity, vanity is characterized by an excessive desire to gain human respect. But like the pride of superiority, it is outward facing and arrogant. The vain seek to impress others and to be constantly held in high esteem. They are prone to showing off and performing and are often found in positions of influence where they can maximize attention and self-aggrandizement. To recognize this kind of vanity, ask yourself these questions. Am I vain about my talents, my status, my looks? Am I anxious to surpass others? Do I spend lots of time showing off on social media? Do I place high value on social media follows and likes and attention? Do I exclude others for their lack of status? Do I give God due credit for my gifts and abilities? And then the last bit of the article is the following. Just as pride is a lie about oneself, humility is the truth about yourself. It is therefore the universal antidote to all forms of pride. Humility is simply honesty about your true destiny as a beloved child of God. The humble neither overestimate nor underestimate their own talents and faults, but honestly acknowledge and repent of sins and defects, and likewise make use of their talents to give glory to God. By praying for and practicing humility, you can combat the sin of pride at its source. Jesus himself is our ultimate model in humility, and you are given many brilliant examples in the humility of the saints. While introspection can be painful, you can gain edifying graces by pursuing a greater understanding of your own soul. As you grow in spiritual maturity, you should seek not only to avoid mortal sin, but to root out the tendencies towards sin. By recognizing these sneaky manifestations of pride, you can overcome spiritual barriers and approach a more profound intimacy with God. Very well said, if you ask me. And I think it speaks for itself. It's there on the show page if you're interested in reading it. Just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick. We'll take a quick pause, and we're coming right back to your phone calls. We have a bunch of people waiting. If you want to jump in and get in on the action, call me at 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
Okay, let's get back to the phone calls. Let's start off with Joseph in Gilbert, Arizona. Good morning, Joseph.
Good morning. I have a question. I have a friend of mine who's a very faithful Christian Protestant. I believe he's Baptist. And we talk about our faith a lot. Mm-hmm. And I really like him. And we talk about justification or salvation, and, you know, he believes that, you know, that you're justified by just your faith in God, and that by his dying on the cross that you're saved. And so I explain, you know, our faith, and he gives his justification about the story of the good thief on the cross, who, when Jesus said, after he defends Jesus, Jesus says, you know, this day you'll be with me in paradise. So he doesn't believe in purgatory or anything like that. So I just wanted to get your opinion on that, and then also how I can further learn about the differences in our faith between Catholic and Baptist, and help to bring them to our faith if that's possible.
Okay, yeah, and it's very possible to do. And it's very possible to bring him into the Catholic Church. In fact, I was in Raleigh this past weekend, Joseph, to speak at a conference, and I was, you know, just kind of quietly went into one of the back pews at the church I went to Mass at on Saturday evening. And a gentleman came over to me. I actually posted a picture of him on Twitter. He came over to me before Mass, and he says, "Oh my gosh," he says, I've always wanted to meet you. He said, you know, introduced himself, and he said, "I recently came into the church some years ago." I said, "What was your background?" He said, "Baptist. I was like Southern Baptist through and through." But he said, "It was listening to your radio program that wound up opening my eyes, and I wound up becoming Catholic." And that overjoyed me to know the power of Catholic radio. So maybe one thing you can do, Joseph, is encourage your Baptist friend to start listening to this program and the other programs. Have him listen to Cale Clark, all the programs, honestly. But that may be a way for him to learn his way into the Catholic Church. It happens all the time. So what about the good thief? Well, it certainly doesn't disprove purgatory. It proves no such thing. All it proves is that God can give grace to whomever he wants, however he wants. And in the case of the good thief on the cross, there was no need to go to purgatory because Jesus had promised him that he was going to go to heaven. Now, there's an interesting little wrinkle here, though, and that is that the good thief, check it out, he didn't go directly to heaven. So when he died, because we know that Jesus died first, and the good thief, actually both thieves, revolutionaries, criminals, whatever they were, their legs were broken by the soldiers to hasten their death because they were still alive. So he did not go directly to heaven. So this actually, when you think about it, it actually makes the case for purgatory. It actually destroys the argument that your friend is trying to make because he didn't go straight to heaven. He went with Jesus where? To purgatory, or at least to the third place where it wasn't hell and it wasn't heaven. It was where those souls of the Old Testament who were destined for heaven were waiting. That's what paradise was referring to. And that's where Jesus went, and that's where he took the good thief. And so they were there in human time terms. We don't know how long, you know, in human time, what that would have been like, but they were there, we're told by St. Peter, that it was there in this prison, as it's described by St. Peter, that Jesus preached to the spirits who were in prison. So that's a passage, by the way, if you want to get a little more specific with him, let me just flip to the passage here. That is in, that's in 1 Peter chapter 3, beginning in verse 18, and then you'll see it again in 1 Peter chapter 4, beginning in verse 6. This is why the gospel is preached even to the dead, that though condemned in the flesh in human estimation, they might live in the spirit in the estimation of God. So it's interesting when you look at it that the good thief story actually proves purgatory. It certainly doesn't disprove it, because in order to disprove it, that would mean the good thief would have to have gone directly to heaven. But he couldn't, because heaven wasn't open yet. Jesus hadn't opened the gates of heaven yet. And before he did that, he went to, we could call it purgatory. The Bible calls it Hades from the Greek, or Sheol from the Hebrew. And that's where he went, and that's where he got those people, and then he brought them to heaven. So the good thief actually did make a stop there before he went to heaven. Isn't that interesting?
Yes, it is. Are there other references to paradise, so that, you know, he may argue that paradise is heaven?
Oh, he might, but all you have to do is to show him 1 Peter chapter 3 and 1 Peter chapter 4, which tells us exactly where he went, and heaven isn't a prison. So there were no spirits in heaven other than the angels. So it's definitive that he didn't go directly to heaven. But if you wanted to do a word search, you know, go on blueletterbible.org and you can do a word search. It's not hard to do. And it would depend upon which translation you're looking at. But so as for a resource, you asked me for a resource. I would give him, you could give him a copy of Carl Keating's book called Catholicism and Fundamentalism. And that book came out in 1988. It's a, I'd say, sort of a tour de force refutation of all the major and many of the minor objections that Baptists and other fundamentalists make against the Catholic Church. It's quite well done. And there's really no stone left unturned in that book. Another book, you hear me recommend it just because it's one of those books that really has a great track record of bringing people home to the Catholic Church, and that is Surprised by Truth. You want the first volume, Surprised by Truth, 11 Converts Give the Biblical and Historical Reasons for Becoming Catholic. And he may say, ain't no way I'll ever become Catholic. Well, give him this book. And he may be asking you to sponsor him into the Catholic Church in due time. It happens all the time when people read that book. Those testimonies that would are very be powerful. Wonderful. Yeah. I could tell stories, Joseph. It's amazing. So yeah, those testimonies are helpful, and they do get into purgatory, and they get into the Mass, and they get into salvation and Mary and the papacy. And you know, one of the stories in the book is by Tim Staples. And he used to be a very emphatically anti-Catholic guy until he met a Catholic who knew the Bible better than he did. And little by little, Tim Staples eventually realized that he was in the wrong place, so he wound up becoming Catholic. It is a powerful book.
Well, that sounds great. Thank you. Thank you, Patrick. I really appreciate your insight into this.
You're most welcome, Joseph. Thank you. And it's good that you're doing what you're doing. Keep at it. And I'm sure in due time, your friend will thank you. 888-914-9149. How about Tracy now in Wausau, Wisconsin? I was just in Wausau, Wisconsin, not that long ago. Good morning, Tracy.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Patrick. Yeah, I kind of in the same line as the last caller. I was in a setting with some good Christian men, and I'm mostly the minority. There might be one or two Catholics in our group, but the one gentleman, he knows I'm Catholic, and I know indirectly he was trying to get a point across to me about basically once saved, always saved, and right, that you can't get to heaven by works. And I know that we don't believe that. I mean, I think, right, isn't the works are a fruit of good faith, but it's not that we believe that we get to heaven by works. And so I just wanted the same thing as that last call. Mm-hmm. I just have some content that I could look at and sure, maybe share with this good Catholic, good Christian man and have a good conversation.
Sure. Well, this is one of the reasons why I don't encourage Catholic folk like you to be in a setting like that, because number one, you're normally, as you are, outnumbered. And number two, there's a fair amount of error that passes for truth in some of these Bible studies. So let's talk about this issue of works. Works is a bad word in the Protestant lexicon, and so much so that whenever the issue comes up, they'll quote passages like Ephesians 2, verses 8 through 9, which we should all say a hearty amen to, for you are saved by grace through faith. This is a gift of God. This is not of works, lest any man should boast. And what the mistake that they make invariably is they confuse and misunderstand the meaning of works in these contexts, and that is works that are done apart from God's grace. So it is God's grace that saves us, but you'll notice in Ephesians 2, it says, for you are saved by grace through faith. This is a gift of God. It's not of works, lest anyone should boast. You'll notice that the faith is itself a kind of work, because you have to have the faith. Point this out to your friend. Just say, does God have faith in himself and then pretend that you had faith in him? No. Who has to do the act of having faith? You do. So it is a work. It's a work of your intellect and your will to say, yes, I believe. Yes, I have faith. That is a kind of work. Similar in a way to praying for somebody. Not all works are necessarily physical. Good works can be done in your mind, like praying for somebody, etc. So this is where the root cause of the problem is that they misunderstand. So this, it's almost Pavlovian. When they see the word work, they assume that this means that you're trying to earn your salvation. And of course you can't. What it's saying here is that God's grace, which is a gift, is what accounts for both your faith and your works. Because it goes on from there in verses 10 and forward to talk about how you were created for good works and God wants you to do good works, but you can't take credit for it because it's ultimately his grace that enables you to have the faith and the works. And the two go hand in hand. St. James talks a lot about that in James chapter 2. He says, you have faith? Great. I'll show you my faith by my works. So in a certain sense, it is true that your good works are a manifestation of your faith. The good works must accompany your faith, as St. James says in James chapter 2. But listen to what St. Paul says in Romans chapter 2. This is important, and I would encourage you to mark this down in your Bible and spend a little time reading this with him. So I'm just going to begin. I'll begin in verse 4. Do you hold his priceless kindness, forbearance, and patience in low esteem, unaware that the kindness of God would lead you to repentance? By your stubbornness and impenitent heart, you are storing up wrath for yourself for the day of wrath and revelation of the just judgment of God, who will repay everyone according to his works. Eternal life to those who seek glory, honor, and immortality through perseverance in good works, but wrath and fury to those who selfishly disobey the truth and obey wickedness. Yes, affliction and distress will come upon every human being who does evil, Jew first and then Greek, but there will be glory, honor, and peace for everyone who does good, Jew first and then Greek. There is no partiality with God. Now, that's Romans chapter 2, you can begin reading about verse 4. You can begin in verse 1 if you choose, but there's a little bit of a preamble there. Take a look also at 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10. And there we see kind of an echo of the same thing. It says, for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive recompense according to what he did in the body, whether good or evil. This is something that is taken up in many different passages. Jesus says, why do you say to me, Lord, Lord, but do not do what I command you? He doesn't say, why do you say to me, Lord, Lord, but not have faith in me? Obviously, that's presupposed, but he says the wise man is the one who hears these words of mine and does them. So there's an action component to this. And the mistake is to say that any kind of work ever is you taking credit or you boasting or you trying to earn your salvation, none of which is true. I mean, that harkens back to a heresy that arose at the time of St. Augustine, and that is the heresy of Pelagianism, which held, it was an English monk who held this view. St. Augustine did battle with this notion and vanquished it, thankfully. And he was saying that you have the natural capacity to be saved, so you do all the good things and you pray and you do all that, and God adds in whatever grace is necessary and you can go to heaven that way. St. Augustine stomped on that. He said, no, it's God's grace from beginning to end. It's not your works. It's not even your faith if it's done in a way that's apart from God's grace. So it's not so simple as your friend thinks if he just says, oh, well, works, and you're trying to earn your salvation. No, not at all. When God gives you this grace, he enables you to do these things that are not saving before that. Now, there's so much more to talk about here, Tracy. It's a big topic. In a way, it's actually a very simple topic, but it is part of the bigger picture, the bigger error of once saved, always saved. That's a whole separate error, but the two are related to each other. So those are some things you can talk about if you want to discuss the issue of works.
Oh, that's wonderful. Fire hose of information. I will definitely be listening to this again and share that. I don't know, I think it'd be a good idea to share this part of your segment with him.
Yeah, please
maybe
do.
Maybe he'll expand on the listening then.
Maybe and this is a respectful suggestion. He would be very welcomed here. He'll be respected, and we can have a fine conversation. But I would welcome him to call in and, as Pat Benatar would say, hit me with your best shot. Let's talk about salvation. Let's talk about once saved, always saved. Let's talk about the role of works from the Bible. I would welcome a conversation on the air if he'd be interested. So please extend my heartfelt and sincere invitation to him, not only to listen, but to call in if you'd like to do so. Thanks, Tracy. Keep doing what you're doing. and maybe give him a copy of that book I mentioned earlier, Surprised by Truth. I'll be right back with Hour 2 right after this.